Welcome to a special episode of the Irish People podcast. We decided to do this episode in light of the recent and frankly shameful decision by the British courts to grant the United States extradition request for Julian Assange. We are joined by Chris Williamson, former Labour MP for Derby North, a close ally of Corbyn, one of the few MPs who fought against the fake anti-Semitism smears, and who ultimately paid the price for opposing the right-wing coup in Labour. Chris is a champion of Palestine, a committed internationalist and anti-imperialist, and passionate animal rights campaigner. Chris is helping build a left alternative across England. He has been central to the campaign to free Julian Assange, and it's fair to say a true champion of social justice. We are also joined by Phil Kelly, activist and regular media commentator. Phil is a strong champion of Cuba and a committed internationalist and anti-imperialist. You're both very welcome and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting us. Very pleased to be here.
If we could start then by giving a brief background on the case, why it's important and how you got involved in the case. Chris, if we could start with you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, I got involved with it particularly when I became a member of Parliament. And it was interesting because I was one of the few MPs who was prepared to speak up for Julian Assange. And it seemed most Labour MPs and a few Tories were doing their level best to get Julian extradited to Sweden on a trumped up charge. And clearly the pretext really was to get him to Sweden so that he could then be extradited on from there to the United States. And so it seemed to me that, you know, the case was an incredibly important one, that Julian was a crucially important truth teller who had actually exposed both state corruption and the abuse of corporate power as well. But I guess the most significant thing that he did was to expose those appalling war crimes that we have seen repeated on the TV from time to time. And it seems to me that we should be doing everything we can in our power to protect somebody who is a champion of free speech and is somebody who I think is probably the most important investigative journalist anywhere in the world. And the real worry for me is that if they are successful in extraditing Julian to the United States and imprisoning him effectively for life, because he's facing a 175-year jail term, that will chill still further free speech and a genuine free press. And it really, it's sending a warning, it seems to me, to anybody else who might dare to follow in his footsteps. And it's crucially important, I think, that we do hold power to account. The military-industrial complex is completely out of control on both sides of the Atlantic. And, you know, without people like Julian Assange actually shining a light on these abuses of power and these war crimes, then, you know, things will, it seems to me, only get worse. And on that basis, really, I feel it's really important to speak up for him. And I felt that when I was an MP. What was really incredibly disappointing was when I tabled a motion in the House, only five other MPs were prepared to sign it. Four other MPs were prepared to sign it, beg your pardon. Everybody else gave it a wide berth. The political class have really been found wanting here and have not really done their duty, it seems to me, to the people that elect them. As I said, Julian is a crucially important truth teller, and they should be championing his cause. And this is a political decision in the end. I mean, the judiciary have been an absolute disgrace, but in the end, this is a political decision, and the Home Secretary could, just as a stroke of a pen, just bring this to an end right now. And, you know, Julian should be, I mean, the proceedings should be stopped. At the very minimum, he should be given bail. I mean, his mental health is suffering, his physical health is suffering. It's been described as torture by the Nils Melzer, the special rapporteur on torture for the UN, no less. So we have a political prisoner on British soil who's being effectively tortured to death. And yet you have, you know, ministers and the Labour opposition pontificating about human rights in other countries when they are prepared to do this to somebody of Julian Assange's stature. It's an absolute outrage, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, Chris has covered it very succinctly there. The truth is not a crime. And, you know, it was Che Guevara that said of people living in the West that you live in an invisible cage. And I think Yanis Varoufakis was right when he said that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks constructed a digital mirror and turned it back on Big Brother and kind of exposed what lies behind the curtain. And that is an unforgivable crime to the powers, the elites that run our society, a real threat. And that's why what you're witnessing is the slow murder of a man for having the audacity to reveal the truth. And I think that is a damning indictment of what lies behind the kind of the Western society as a whole.
Absolutely. And I mean, if I could just add, I think it was Slavoj Žižek who said that, or described Julian as a spy, but he's not a spy who spies for the powerful, or the people on behalf of the powerful. He's somebody who spies on the powerful on behalf of the people, and that's obviously unconscionable to the, you know, to the wealthy and powerful elites in this country. Well, not just in this country, on both sides of the Atlantic.
The latest decision to overturn the previous ruling is clearly a travesty. The whole decision seems to be based on assurances given by the United States for Julian post-extradition, because they have upheld the fact he is a very real suicide risk, which seems to me to be ludicrous. As we have seen on many occasions, the United States have reneged on their assurances and promises. So is the next stage of the battle to challenge these so-called assurances?
I absolutely, I mean, look, any assurance, I don't know what Phil thinks, but any assurance from the United States of America seems to me to be not worth the paper that it's written on. And the arguments that the lawyers on behalf of the US are putting in court, they just seem to me to be absurd. And I know I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, you've got this character, James Lewis, for the prosecution, arguing that Julian isn't a political prisoner, that in order, indeed, for him to be deemed to be potentially covered by the provisions of the treaty in terms of, you know, being a political prisoner, that his misdemeanor would have had to have occurred on US territory. And yet, you know, the United States claim universal sort of jurisdiction. So that really doesn't seem to me to add up at all. I think his precise words were in the court to introduce a political offences bar by the back door would be to subvert the intention of Parliament, because he's claiming that Parliament didn't actually legislate to provide for a barrier to extradition being you know, political offences. But that's completely wrong. I mean, when the bill was being debated, this enabling legislation in 2002, the minister was quizzed about this very question, and he was absolutely unequivocal. He said that anybody who was accused of a political offence would not be subject to extradition. And it seems to me as well that the, you know, the prosecution are seeking to have the cake and eat it, really, because on the one hand they're saying that the Extradition Act doesn't, you know, provide for you know, political barrier to extradition. They're saying that the treaty hasn't been incorporated, the extradition treaty hasn't been incorporated into British law. But that's just kind of a nonsense, it seems to me, because, as I've said, the Extradition Act, 2003 Extradition Act, is an enabling act. And it, you know, it's given form, if you like, through the treaty. Now, the treaty wasn't signed because, you know, it has to be, you know, detailed scrutiny of the, you know, provisions of that have to be agreed by various government departments. And so it didn't actually come into force until 2007. So on the one hand, they are applying or using the treaty to extradite Julian, but then they're saying that the provisions of the treaty do not apply. And let me just quote you a passage from the treaty, which headed under political and military offences. It says explicitly, and I'm quoting from it now, extradition shall not be granted if the offences for which extradition is requested is a political offence. Well, you know, as I've said a number of platforms recently. What could be more political than exposing war crimes? And, you know, for the prosecution or the lawyers for the United States to argue that it only counts, it would only count as a political offence if Julian in this particular case was seeking to overthrow the government of the United States or seeking to change their policy. Well, one would have thought that it was pretty obvious that by exposing these war crimes, these abuses, that there was a real attempt to change their policy. So the whole thing just doesn't stack up, it seems to me. And yet the judiciary are I think, playing fast and loose here. I mean, Julian should not be subject to these charges at all anyway, and certainly shouldn't be incarcerated in a high security prison when there are alternative means. If they wanted to, you know, put him, you know, release him potentially on bail, they could have a tag on him. If they, you know, they consider him to be a flight risk, who could put him under observation, as it were. But no, they're putting him they're holding him in this high security prison. His mental health is suffering terribly. His physical health is suffering as well. And indeed, on the day of the last hearing, he suffered a stroke. I mean, you know, the man's only 50 years of age. He's been in a high security prison for over 2 years now. Prior to that, he was in the Ecuadorian embassy. I think it was for around seven years. So he's effectively been incarcerated for around, 9, 10 years at least. And he was due, indeed, he was originally imprisoned in Belmarsh for breaking the terms of his original bail. And that sentence only was for a year. And he was due to be released, I think, on the 22nd of September last year. And yet he's being detained because the judge barrister claims that he's a flight risk. But as I've said, there are other ways and means of managing somebody they deem to be a flight risk. And this really has shamed, in my opinion, shamed Britain, and it's an issue, I think, which should concern all of us, because it's not just about the inhuman treatment of one individual. This is about, as I've already said, freedom of press, freedom of speech, and you know, who knows where this is going to end in terms of what other draconian measures will be brought in that will affect more people. And will enable the government to essentially just get away with murder. There are no real scrutiny at all to the nefarious activities of the state. That can't be right.
Well, Chris hits the key point that this whole debacle shames the United Kingdom internationally, because when we talk about the global community, often people imagine the United States of America, Canada, the EU, the United Kingdom are the global community. They are the periphery. And the human rights abuses of these Western powers are well known by the victims of them across the world. But what it does show, and if you think about the kind of language around Brexit, was about taking back control, sovereignty. But what this horrible crime against Assange, against journalism, against revealing the truth, shows that Britain is not a global power, that it is essentially a vassal state of the United States of America. And the treatment of Julian Assange and the denial of being able to liaise with his legal representation, his inhumane treatment within Belmarsh, which is designed to break him as a human being, serves no other purpose, is an indictment of the United Kingdom. And if you think about the United States of America, no one should be extraditing anyone to the United States of America, given the conditions within their prison system, but also given the disregard and contempt that the United States of America, their government, has for international law and for the will of the international community. They constantly ignore the votes of the United Nations and act unilaterally in an aggressive manner throughout the world. And I'm also thinking, when you think of the kidnapping of a Venezuelan diplomat, it isn't much discussed in Western media, but Alex Saab was essentially kidnapped and extradited to the United States of America, and his crime was seeking to import food to Venezuela around the blockade, which is illegal under international law imposed by the United States government. Also, what the Julian Assange, the crime against Julian Assange reveals is it should kill the kind of liberal hope. You know, during the Trump administration, we were treated to almost universal revulsion as to the actions of that administration. But you'll remember when a pop singer and a poet appeared at the inauguration of Joe Biden, it seemed like the world had changed and everyone felt we were in a better place. But the same horror story of the United States government, of their regime, continues unchanged. They still want to effectively condemn Julian Assange to a death sentence for the crime of revealing their crimes. Now, Chris also hit on the point, what has he done? It's either political, and you want to extradite him for a political reason, which there should be no basis for, or he's committed a crime. What crime has he committed, and how can he have committed treason against the United States of America? It's this arrogance which views the United States, views itself as the world, and that, you know, you can commit a crime against them, whoever you are, and be subject to their laws of treason. It's an obscenity. It's an affront to UK sovereignty and justice, and it's an affront to anyone who believes in basic human rights and dignity, and also the kind of sacred duty that journalism has in our society. And it also, the whole debacle has really shone a light into British journalism and the failure of British journalism, which has actually been just to exist to either amplify the ludicrous charges of the US State Department or to offer silence. I mean, to give you one local example, I mean, in your introduction, you introduced me as a regular commentator to local media. On the day that the United States managed to overturn the original decision, our local media ignored what had happened to Julian Assange and ran a debate around a smoking ban in New Zealand. Now, how can anyone within media who claims to be a journalist claim that title and ignore what is happening to Julian Assange? I mean, this crime against this man, it calls on all who believe in truth, who all believe in journalism, to call it out and take up the mantle that he took up and which he's being punished for. So it's a hugely important case. It's hugely damaging to the United Kingdom, and rightly so. And it needs more people to engage in it, more people to stand up and start fighting this fight against these ludicrous extradition charges.
Yeah, I think the other thing we should also bear in mind when we're talking about extraditing Julian to the United States is that the CIA, according to documents that were leaked into the public domain, were actually plotting to kidnap and assassinate him on British soil. This is incredible. They have a foreign state plotting to kidnap and murder somebody, assassinate somebody on British soil. And we're talking about extraditing him, seriously talking about extraditing him to that very country. I mean, it would, you know, it'd be laughable if it wasn't so tragic and so serious.
It's completely obscene. The silence from the mainstream media has been appalling. But worse has been the deafening silence from many on the left, which has been to their eternal shame. If we look at the smear campaign against Julian Assange, the attacks on his character, the papers were full of provocative stories designed to vilify him in the eyes of the public. Much like the smear campaign against Corbyn and other figures in the Labour Party. Do you believe that the security state is behind these things? Because it would be fairly clear to me that the security state controls the mainstream media.
Well, it very much looks that way. I mean, when I was making some investigations into a shady organisation called the Integrity Initiative, a so-called charity that's received multi-million pound payout from the Foreign Office and from the Ministry of Defence, we discovered that they were actually setting about smearing Jeremy Corbyn and senior figures in the Labour Party when Jeremy was the leader of the party and offering us a hope of a socialist domestic agenda and an anti-imperialist foreign policy. And that, I think, was unconscionable, clearly, to the establishment and to, you know, sort of senior figures in society, and particularly in the military industrial complex. And, you know, they were determined to take him down. But on their sort of payroll, as it were were numerous high profile, so-called respected journalists, actually, who were their kind of assets. And they deployed them, you know, on an as and when basis. It was very much reminiscent of Operation Mockingbird that the CIA established in the 1950s at the height of the Cold War. And it was exposed, I think, in the Church Committee inquiry into Watergate about 20 or so years later in the mid-1970s, that, you know, these people were on the CIA payroll and they were essentially, you know, doing their level best to, you know, promote the position of the administration of the day, to sort of demonize the civil rights movement. They infiltrated the civil rights movement, you know, did their level best to undermine them. And, you know, this integrity initiative was very much seen to me anyway, operating from that sort of CIA playbook. But they'd expanded it to not just the UK, but really across Europe and indeed the world. And there was a case of Pedro Baños, as a well-respected a Spanish figure, served with distinction in the Spanish military, was a socialist who was lined up to take on the role of the director of the Homeland Security. And he'd made some fairly inane remarks about Russia and basically made the point that he didn't see in reality that Russia posed any meaningful threat to Spanish interests. And for that, he was absolutely monstered. Social media smearing campaign. There were articles placed in the mainstream media in Spain, and then the role that he was deemed to be odds-on favourite to take on no longer was available to him. And I think it was Penguin. He'd written a book as well, and he found that his book was taken out of circulation, and the remaining stocks that they had were pulped. So this is the sort of powers that we are that we're fighting, the vested interests that we are up against.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a country which knows only too well through painful experience that there is no limit to what British state intelligence agencies will do in terms of collusion. Even today, when I think about the news that broke of the Miami shoe ban compensation of collusion between security forces and loyalist paramilitaries. So we're acutely aware that there is no limits on how far they'll push things. And if you expand it to the kind of smear campaign that happened within the Labour Party, which was promoted by members within the Labour Party, often with links to the Israeli regime, it's important to note that, you know, that you get a lot of the kind of pantomime left commentators on media who jumped on board with the smears. You'll know who I'm talking about. We're happy to see people like Chris, a lifelong anti-racist, vilified and accused of the very thing he spent his life fighting against. But it's important to remember that if there is a regime which is committing human rights abuses, genocide on a daily basis, then that regime is going to sure as hell lobby within the West to cover the tracks of its crimes. And the Israeli government is doing that exactly. And you can see the influence that they have within the British political establishment and within the major British political party. So the Corbyn moment, if you like, it was essentially destroyed by its inability to stand up to those smears. I think that Chris was unique in his fight back against that and paid the ultimate price on that. And if you think of the socialist campaign group within the Parliamentary Labour Party, which is supposedly the left of this grand coalition of Labour, sat on their hands and offered nothing but silence as Chris was character assassinated. It was always going to happen. He put himself in the crosshairs by speaking out, speaking truth to power. And it's interesting to see how many so-called socialists within the Labour Party let him pay the price for doing that. So, yes, I think it's clear that, you know, if you can point me to a country, you know, we were fed a diet of Russiagate over the last number of years. But if you can point me to a country where the CIA and US intelligence agencies are not seeking to undermine or influence, then go ahead. I can't think of one, you know, their attempts to destabilize the elections in Nicaragua, Venezuela, their attempts to foment insurrection in Cuba, which failed in November, you know, their the tentacles that lead back to the coup in Bolivia in 2019, their attempts at regime change in Iran and across the globe. So, you know, it's important, and that's why WikiLeaks is such an important tool in fighting back against that, to expose what is actually going on below the surface, to expose the hypocrisy that the West is built on. And that is why, for the United States government, Julian Assange represents public enemy number one.
Absolutely. And just in relation to the role of the state and indeed the media in terms of, you know, regime change activities, earlier this year, Max Blumenthal wrote a really illuminating article for The Grey Zone exposing the role of the BBC and Reuters who were engaged in regime change activities in Russia. I mean, everything that the British state has accused Russia of doing, the British state is doing tenfold or more even in Russia. I mean, it's an absolutely preposterous state of affairs. And the point about journalists as well in relation explicitly to Julian, some you know, senior journalists, people like Suzanne Moore, when Julian originally sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in 2012, she was quoted as saying, "I bet Assange is stuffing himself full of flattened guinea pigs. He really is the most massive turd." This is what, you know, this kind of senior reporter is saying. And in an article for The New Statesman, after he was dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy, she said that he referred to him as a demented looking gnome being pulled out of the Ecuadorian embassy by the secret police of the deep state, or the Met, as normal people call them. It's astonishing that, you know, that this type of language by, you know, so-called, you know, senior columnists and reporters is given even any sort of space at all in any newspaper which, you know, claims to be a sort of, you know, serious and credible news outlet. Clearly it's not. But what really sickened me was that she went on then to win the Orwell Prize for Journalism the same year. I mean, it's unbelievable, isn't it? And you know what it was supposed to be for? It was for her, this is, and I'm quoting, for her stubborn and brave commentary. What, stubborn and brave commentary, referring to Julian Assange, who genuinely is a stubborn and brave commentator, referring to him as a demented-looking gnome being pulled out of the Ecuadorian embassy by the secret police of the deep state, or the Met, as normal people call him, and referring to him as stuffing himself full of flattened guinea pigs. He's the most massive turd. You know, it's offensive in the extreme. And these people are the ones that, you know, they're at the top of, allegedly at the top of their game. But in general, I mean, obviously that's just one example. There are many others of the sort of ridiculing that Julian was subjected to by these hacks. They're not really journalists, they're hacks, and they bring the what should be an honourable profession, in my opinion, into disrepute. And they're, unless they're sort of ridiculing him, they're actually silent. I mean, and certainly for the most part, since Julian has been incarcerated in Belmarsh, you know, they've said nothing. I mean, people like senior reporter Nick Cohen, who, you know, described Julian's supporters who were concerned about his welfare and what might happen to him, and referred to them as the definition of paranoia, and called Julian the incontinent leaker, and was full of all sorts of assurances that, the US Constitution, you know, the First Amendment, the finest defense of freedom of speech, and saying how the American Civil Liberties Union was saying it's unlikely that they'd pursue any action against Julian. And this was when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy. And now we know what is happening. And yet, they're saying very little. Other than, you know, as I say, these pejorative remarks, I mean, they've got nothing to say about the situation. And so, you know, the people that Cohen was referring to as the definition of paranoid, I mean, they were right. And he was absolutely wrong, wasn't he, in his assessment of what was happening. But, you know, it's interesting as well, isn't it, that, you know, the Obama administration, of which Joe Biden was a part, were planning to drop any action against Julian Assange before he left office. But then, of course, 2016 happened, And we know that Julian exposed the fact that the DNC were basically cheating, and they cheated Bernie Sanders out of being the Democratic nominee and installed the pillar of the establishment, you know, the spokesperson for the establishment, a mouthpiece for the elites. And obviously, as we know, she went on to lose. And it's interesting, isn't it, how the Democrats have hardened their position since then. What else has changed in the intervening period? I mean, in 2013, I think it was, they were talking about dropping the any action against Julian Assange. And now they are gunning for him in an even more aggressive way, it seems, than even the Donald Trump administration was doing. So, yeah, I mean, it's a real tragedy, and it really brings a whole kind of, you know, political, you know, the sort of political discourse and the whole sort of, you know, political system into complete disrepute on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, it's got no credibility here, and it's got no credibility in the States either. I mean, you know, if you many, many people on both sides of the Atlantic who commentate on this sort of thing are outraged by it. But the people who are charged with, you know, representing the people are just doing the bidding of the establishment, doing the bidding of the big corporations, the military industrial complex, and not actually living up to their responsibility. As I say, that's the same in the States, and it's the same here. And it really is a pretty pass that we've come to where, you know, we've got politicians who are just not fit for purpose.
I think the depressing reality is that when you place this into the kind of geopolitical landscape at the moment, and what Chris is saying is what has changed, and what has changed is the kind of the re-energizing of a new Cold War, particularly with reference to China, and the United States and its puppets, if you like, its satellite states are really clamoring toward that end. And that's why I'm not particularly optimistic for Julian's chances, because if you look at Australia, he's an Australian citizen. Australia has signed military deals recently with the US, which is all about ramping up threats and saber rattling towards China. The UK government is powerless as a global power, and is increasingly, you know, has to do the bidding of the US and even the EU. So if you look at in terms of Venezuela, about the recognition of Juan Guaido, now 8% of the global community recognize the anointed president of Venezuela, the US anointed president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, is the country's president. That's 8% recognize that US endorsed president, while the rest of the global community recognize reality. So, you know, in that context, my hopes for Julian Assange are not high. I would have no faith in the British justice system. And I think it's a deeply dangerous new reality that we've entered. And as Chris says, if you look at the supposed defenders of journalism, they're not there. They're not taking this case. They're ignoring it, or they're taking part in the character assassination. And if you look at the so-called hopeful new left that we have, people like AOC are absolutely silent or towing the DNC line on it. You know, so there is not that kind of resistance within mainstream political parties against this. Yeah. And again, that's just a further indictment of where we're at within the United States of America and then within the UK.
The inhumanity of the case alone is disturbing. The inhuman treatment of Julian during this whole case. But one of the things that also stands out is the conflicts of interest in this case and the judges who have presided over it. In the latest, Judge Burnett is close friends with Alan Duncan, who has been instrumental in the persecution of Julian Assange. Lady Arbuthnot had massive conflicts of interest. That itself makes it impossible for him to have a fair hearing or a fair trial. When there are people making the judgments, like Judge Burnett, who had lunch with Alan Duncan the week of the verdict, he said the trial was not discussed, one of the most important trials of our lifetime, and it wasn't discussed. The whole thing is just incredibly suspect, to say the least.
It's a travesty. It's an absolute travesty of justice. There's no doubt about that. And I think what's really important, therefore, is that we do everything we can to highlight that, because of the reasons we've already outlined. There's a sort of conspiracy of silence, it seems, in the corporate media. And so the independent media and podcasts like this and so on are, you know, become even more important than they previously were. Because I think, you know, when you actually speak to people about this absolutely grotesque injustice, which is being done in our name, let's remember this, because those of us that live, you know, in the UK, it's being done in our name. We're supposedly living in a democracy. People are absolutely appalled. You know, I was talking to a chap, you know, just a regular guy the other day, and he vaguely heard of Julian Assange, but he was absolutely astonished when I told him. He almost kind of was incredulous. This can't really be happening. This is Britain. This can't be happening. You know, when you kind of explain to people what is being done in our name, it's as I say, you know, it's very antithesis of what justice should be about. You know, people are absolutely up in arms about it. And so I guess that's one of the reasons why there has been this conspiracy of silence, because I think, you know, if people were widely aware of this, I mean, this, you know, should be an international, well, it is an international court celebre, but seemingly not in this country. You know, I just don't think people would tolerate it. I mean, there'll be a lot more people protesting than there already is. And so that's why I say this, you know, things like this are really important, because as I've said on other platforms, I think in the end, this is going to be a political decision, and we therefore need, I believe, to ratchet up the political pressure. What's so tragic is, I mean, you kind of expect it from the Tories, although to be fair, there are some Tories which are downside better than the people on the opposition benches and the Labour benches. But, you know, it was mainly, as I think I was saying earlier in our just discussion this evening, Labour MPs that were straining at the leash to demand that Julian be extradited to Sweden. You know, we know this was a pretext. We know the reason for that was so that he could then be, you know, transferred to the United States. But huge amount of pressure was being applied, you know, to the Home Secretary at the time. People like Stella Creasy really ratcheting up the pressure on the Home Secretary. And, you know, numerous parliamentarians were signing up to that. And you compare that to the number that were prepared to put the name to the motion that I tabled. You know, it really shows, it brings into sharp relief, I think, just how unfit for purpose our parliamentarians really are. But they are prone to pressure. They are subject to pressure. And I think if we can build that pressure, and if they start to worry about their career, you know, then that, you know, might sort of, you know, make them look afresh at this issue. We need people to start, you know, putting their head above the parapet. A few are now, to be fair. I mean, it's encouraging to see, you know, people like Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell and Richard Bergen and some others. Not enough, and nowhere near enough. What was disappointing was that they weren't raising their voices when they had more of an influence in the House when Jeremy was the leader. And as I say, there was me, and that was it, really, and a handful of others that would, you know, deign to put their name to a motion that I put forward. I think there were three Labour MPs and an independent, and that was it.
I think it's vital to make the wider public aware. You know, you covered one point, Kiva, the conflict of interest that surrounds this case, which is a story in itself. And often a fairly consistent story around the British justice system. But just the inhumanity of the treatment of this man, who is at best 22 hours in a cell a day, lucky to get 30 minutes exercise, denied consultation with his legal team, and actually even had notes that he was taking while in the courtroom confiscated. So a complete attempt to undermine any ability he has to defend himself or be an active participant in his own defence, and to physically, mentally break the spirit of the man. we know about that again in the society where political prisoners were treated, but at least they were part of a wider network and supported by people in the community. Julian Assange is suffering this cross alone in Belmarsh, and the light of the world should be shining in that solitary cell to expose what the UK establishment is doing to this man. It stands in sharp contrast as well when you think of the Harry Dunn case and Britain's inability to try and get the woman who killed Harry Dunn extradited here, and the US taking a very firm line on that. And also, if you think back to Augusto Pinochet, who in the 90s was wanted for crimes against humanity, and the then New Labour government folded, saying, no, this man is suffering in his health, a mass murderer, a butcher, and he was allowed to return a free man to Chile. You think about what has happened to Julian Assange, his health. I mean, this is a man, and Chris would know the impact on him more than I, but who hasn't actually stood in the sunlight for many, many years, who, you know, is being treated in a way in Belmarsh, which is subhuman, which is an indictment of the UK prison system, and being threatened being sent to face the rest of his natural life in a supermax prison in the United States. And these prisons are an affront to humanity in the United States. They're a crime against humanity. They are completely designed to destroy people. To be sent to supermax is to receive a death sentence, in my eyes. And for what? To be accused of treason against a country that you're not even a citizen of? It's obscene. If the public cannot see this or cannot be made aware of it, then the price that Julian plays is a heavy one, but the price that we all pay is a heavy one, and we should keep that in mind too.
Yeah, and the other thing, just on the point you make there, Phil, about Augusto Pinochet, he wasn't held in prison when he was here. He was living a life of Riley while he was sort of, as it were, being detained or prevented from leaving these shores. And as you say, you know, the government folded and allowed him to. I mean, this is a man who was, as you say, responsible for crimes against humanity. I mean, the appalling oppression, the murders, the death squads, the torture that went on under his watch. You contrast that with Julian Assange and what he's trying to do in exposing war crimes, in exposing the abuse of state power, and exposing the abuse of corporate power. And he's being treated like this. My God. I mean, it's so sickening. It's so sickening. It's hard to find words, really, to find that adequately, describe, my feelings and about this absolute scandalous state of affairs.
I think one of the reasons they have had such a smear campaign against his character is he is someone who stands for journalistic integrity, and his work stands up for truth. So by having these smear campaigns against him, unfortunately, people read this, and you have mentioned the type of language used by some journalists in relation to him. Julian's case is just not getting the coverage it needs. The truth and the facts are not being reported in the mainstream media. So it's vital that his campaign make their own media as much as possible. Our podcast is relatively new, but we wanted to do this episode in an attempt to bring the truth to light, even if it only reaches a small number of people who think, I need to look into this case a bit more, then that's really important.
Yes, indeed. I completely agree. The more of these types of podcasts and discussions that we can secure on the independent media, the better, really. And look, the independent media is cutting through in a way that it never did in the past. I mean, back in the day, of course, we never had that opportunity. We had to try and get our message out through the prism of the mainstream corporate media. I mean, other than public meetings or face-to-face discussions with people, distributing leaflets and so on, it was very, very difficult. But we do have alternative mechanisms now, notwithstanding the way in which they're trying to manipulate the algorithms on the social media platforms, etc. That's why initiatives like Panquake, I think, are so important, which is a kind of an alternative democratic platform which is being developed now, I believe. And we need to, you know, give that support as well. And, you know, a truly open democratic platform where we can have these, you know, these discussions, because, you know, things have really deteriorated. Things are far worse, it seems to me, today when we're talking about, you know, repression, freedom of speech, etc. I mean, you think back, you know, to Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers 50 or so years ago, when he exposed the kind of, you know, abuses, war crimes of the United States in Vietnam. And of course, and there was an attempt to prosecute him as well. But I mean, ultimately, you know, he was acquitted, and, you know, the First Amendment sort of, you know, prevailed there. Although they're trying to, you know, the other thing they're trying to say is that it doesn't apply to, this is one of the things I think they were saying a year or so back, doesn't apply to Julian because he's not an American citizen. I mean, using every dirty trick in the book, they're absolutely determined to send a warning signal, to punish him and to shut him up forever, and to send a warning signal. And they'll use every dirty, filthy trick in the book to actually get their way. And that's why it's so important, I think, that we stand together in solidarity against this. Because they're coming for Julian today, they might be coming for us tomorrow. And that's not, you know, that's not over-exaggeration. And it's not, you know, indulging in hyperbole. We really are, you know, at that sort of level, it seems to me. And people need to wake up and, you know, just come back to the point that you make, you know, about the importance of these sort of independent platforms like this. I can't really stress that enough. And so thank you for giving it the oxygen of the publicity that you're doing tonight. And hopefully people that listen to this will be enlightened and help to spread the word and, you know, and build that campaign for Julian and for ourselves. I mean, it's our own self-interest as well as Julian's interest, it seems to me.
That is a critical point. We are sleepwalking into a nightmare. And if you think about the big communication platforms, which are now run by corporations who label various Twitter or Facebook accounts state affiliated, while they themselves operate as an arm of the US State Department. So while liberals clapped like seals when Donald Trump was removed from Twitter, what they ignored was the thousands of Nicaraguans who were wiped off Twitter for the crime of supporting their own government. The thousands of accounts wiped off that are present in Cuba for the crime of defending their revolution, the government accounts of Venezuelan government ministries. You know, these are very sinister corporations with a different agenda. And it brings me to that idea of the Matrix. And this is why WikiLeaks and the work of Julian Assange is so important. You offer the public the two pills, the blue pill and the red pill. And if you take the blue pill, all you see is the lies and the facade that Western society wants to present you with, the lies around their government and how that is supported and spun by a compliant media. Or you choose to take the very difficult pill, the red pill, and see the reality of what lies beneath. And WikiLeaks and Julian Assange risked a lot to give us a glimpse of what lies beyond. And the horror of what lies beyond should be a rallying cry to everyone who believes in truth, who believes in freedom, who believes in actual democratically engaged citizenship, rather than the kind of cocooned lives we lead to enable the kind of crimes that are committed against us and in our name around the world.
So finally, to finish up, what can people do to support the campaign and to spread the word? Like, obviously, to talk to people wherever possible. You know, I've written to Julian Assange himself. I've written to various MPs, which sounds a bit simple. But at this stage, I feel we really need a very joined up approach, more coordination. We have campaigns in different countries, and I think it's important that all the campaigns work together in a coordinated way to put as much pressure on the United States, but also on Britain and Australia, to have the extradition dropped.
I think that coordination is crucially important, Kiva, I really do. I think there's been some attempt to try to build that coordination. More needs to be done. I think there is certainly a role. I mean, you mentioned you've written to your MP, and I know it sounds a bit softball to do that, but, you know, if we get lots of people doing that, that is helpful in their own way. I would encourage people to find out more, you know, dig it out. It's available on the internet. I mean, it's not, might not be in the corporate media, but it's possible to find out information about the campaign to save Julian Assange and to save free speech and the free press. Get involved in organizations like, you know, Free the Truth and so on. Turn up when you can to the, you know, to the rallies, etc. And build pressure to, you know, to call on those that are, you know, involved in running the campaigns to do what you say, you know, to put a build that international coordination. I think that is important that we do more of that. As I say, there's been some attempt, but it's, you know, it need to, we need to build that. And, you know, we need to build, you know, we need to build influential support too. I mean, there's, you know, obviously people like Roger Waters and, you know, celebrities, et cetera, have come out and spoken very, very passionately, very eloquently. You know, and there are, you know, some parliamentarians in other countries. And it's about, I think, trying to pull all of that together. So, yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. And we need to do what we can to build that coordination. And I think, you know, people can play a part in urging those that are involved in sort of running the campaign, the Julian Assange campaign, to you know, try and, you know, build that international coordination. But in the meantime, as I say, sign up for more information, join the campaign and help to spread the word. And, you know, as I say, the more people that are aware of this story, I think the more horrified, you know, people will be. And that, I think, can only help to, you know, to build the pressure to bring about the justice that is, you know, so sadly lacking in this case so far.
I agree with everything, but my final take would be that, you know, we can't see what's happening to Julian Assange in isolation. That what motivates my politics and my kind of activism is the idea of unity and struggle. That the crime being perpetrated against Julian Assange is part of a greater picture, which links up to the imperialist kind of threat to global peace and security across the world. I mentioned earlier the kidnapping of Alex Saab, a diplomat, his torture, his denial of being able to have his post-cancer medicines in the United States. That has to be a definition of torture. These things are all connected, and that's why you're starting, or you have seen, the governments in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua call out the kind of rank hypocrisy where the United States only last week held a summit of democracy. Because as it retreats away from the UN, where it can no longer control, it now tries to create this new axis of evil branded under the title the Conference for Democracy, which is an absurd front considering that they've invited to this ridiculous carnival of the absurd, people like Juan Guaido and his representatives, coups, people who are committing actual treason against their own nations and helping undermine sovereignty and international law. So what is happening to Assange? We must call out this hypocrisy from the West, the lies when it stands on a platform and tries to lecture other countries falsely about their human rights. Then we need to turn the mirror, as Assange turned the mirror on them, and expose them for what they are: hypocrites, criminals who debase the ideas of democracy and human rights. And that struggle then links it into what's happening in Palestine, what's happening in Latin America, Africa, in terms of modern neo-colonialists and corporations exploiting the wealth of that continent, all part of the same struggle that we all must join the dots on and stand together. And it won't be easy. It's very difficult to break through because of the way our media creates an atmosphere of apathy and of not wanting to delve into too much detail. So we have a lot to contend with, but we have to do it because there is no alternative. The alternative to fighting this is to meekly take the blue pill and accept the lies.
Yeah, very much so.
I completely agree that the Assange case is part of something much bigger. It's a warning, and my fear is that people won't heed that warning. Thank you both so much for taking part in this episode.
It's kind of good to invite us on. Thanks.
And thank you all for listening. If you'd like to read more about Julian Assange's case, you can log on to www.defendassange.org. So until the next episode, slán go fóill.